I'm very happy to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Alan Wiseman. He's a journalist. He's author of several books, including The World Without Us. And his latest book is called Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. Nice to be back.
Nice to be back. Nice to have you back. The book Countdown came out a couple of years ago, and we had you on the show at that time. And this is a book about population on Earth and this whole concept of carrying capacity. Where are we at right now in terms of the number of people on the Earth and the optimal number of people on the Earth?
Well, until the 19th century, we were kind of a natural balance. People died as fast as they were being born, which is pretty much what happens in a balanced ecosystem with any species. And then because of medical improvements in the 19th century, we increased over a billion. We got to 1.5 billion. And then the 20th century, we exploded. It's the most abnormal population spurt in the history of biology. And that's because we learned how to force feed with chemicals our food supply. So first with artificial nitrogen fertilizer, 40% of us wouldn't even be here without it. And then by Green Revolution grains, which grows much more grain per each stalk of either wheat, rice, or corn. And we quadrupled in a century, and now we're at 7.3 billion. We'd been at 1.5 billion at the beginning of the 20th century. We are headed to about more than 9.5 billion by the middle of this century, and right now the prognosis is 11 billion by the end of the century with no end in sight.
And this is because of this combination of vast improvements in medicine and in the way we grow food. I don't know if you can call it improvements in the way we grow food.
Well, you know, these both started out as really good ideas. Yeah. I mean, medical improvements, suddenly we didn't have, you know, astronomical infant mortality, and people lived, instead of average lifespan of 40 years, you know, we've almost doubled that. I mean, who's going to argue against that? And then having more food sounded like a great idea. But the founder of the Green Revolution, when he got his Nobel Peace Prize, he warned everybody that what happens is that when people don't die of famine, they live to reproduce more people who then grow up and live to reproduce more people. So he spent the rest of his life on the board of population groups because he knew that this was going to happen, and it did, unfortunately.
There's a kind of interesting, I don't know if it's an irony, but it's this human phenomenon that you alleviate suffering somewhere and a different kind of suffering pops up somewhere else. You don't just alleviate suffering. You know, you have you have medical technology, which really makes our lives happier, longer, more comfortable, safer. But then when you have a situation where you have this many people on Earth, we're creating tremendous dangers, not only for ourselves, but for so many of the other species on the planet.
You know, nature basically is a constant series of, it's a balancing act, and it's always going on. Any species gets to be too numerous or populous for its environment, it suffers a population crash when it outstrips the resources that it lives on. We humans have learned to tinker with some of the variables, and there have been some really good benefits to ourselves. I mean, you know, anybody over 40 should be thankful for all those medical improvements. But when you jigger one variable, something else is going to respond in an unexpected way. And, you know, the most important part of this to me, when a countdown is not just about our species, it's about all the other species, when we're trying to figure out how many people can fit on this planet without collapsing it, is as we prosper, other species then suffer. Right now, 40% of the land on the planet, more than 40% of the land on the planet that is either not underwater or under ice, is devoted to feeding just one species, our own. And that's one of the reasons why we are now perpetrating the greatest extinction of our companion species on this planet that the world has seen since 65 million years ago, when an asteroid off the dinosaurs and 60% of everything else.
The question of controlling population is something that different societies and different subcultures within societies handle very differently. But something that fascinated me about your book was that it really seems that when a society decides to decrease its birth rate, they can do so very quickly through changes in public policy, which are apparently stronger than long-standing cultures and traditions.
You know, it's not just public policy, because sometimes it's private policy. The problem that I was dealing with in the very beginning, as many readers, you know, because I raised this question at the end of The World Without Us, you know, how can I really wrote that because I wanted a world with us, but when we were increasing by 1 million people every 4.5 days, that's just not going to happen.
Is that really what we're doing?
That's what it is. Yeah, you do the long division on birth minus deaths every year, and this is what you get. And many readers said to me, yes, we must do something about that, but God, the Chinese policy, the one-child policy, that's... I mean, nobody likes that. And it turns out, you know, nobody, the Chinese don't like it either. So my challenge was to see, are there any alternatives to that? And it's interesting because I just got back from China. Countdown was just released in China, and a new edition of World Without Us, which was a big bestseller in China. And I was on a 6-city tour. I gave about 24 talks while I was there. And all the audiences that I was speaking to, I really had this tightrope that I had to walk, because on the one hand, they hate the one-child policy. And they didn't want me coming in and talking about, you know, how we need to control population, because they have suffered. You know, we all know the stories about... you know, female infanticide, which sometimes took place. Those were probably extreme cases, but there was an enormous amount of sex selection through abortions, because the ultrasound machine was invented right around the same time that the one-child policy happened. So people who wanted a male child, were using that. Forced abortions, forced sterilizations. China went through an awful lot.
And also adopting out of girl babies.
Well, that to me is kind of a nice solution to a problem, because, you know, we all see now in America and in Europe this beautiful sprinkling of Chinese females' faces growing up among us. And, you know, to me, adoption is a wonderful way to deal with a population problem. The Chinese scientist who I traveled with while I was doing my research for Countdown explained to me that they know about the pain, but they favor the one-child policy because there'd be 400 million more Chinese without it, and the ecosystem would completely collapse. Their air quality is already stressed enormously, and water is a terrible problem in China right now. But I still had to look for alternatives. And that's why I ended up going to 21 countries. Have any countries found ways that aren't so draconian? And it turns out that China's policy is the exception in the world. They weren't the first, by the way. The United States used forced sterilization on the island of Puerto Rico during the 1930s. Women would go to the doctor for routine reasons and come out with their tubes tied. And the Chinese audiences appreciated hearing that.
That happened to Native American women, too.
Oh, of course, yeah. And it happened in India during the 1970s. There were also a lot of forced vasectomies in India. But in many different cultures that I went to, Mexico, Buddhist Thailand, Catholic Italy, Muslim Iran, they have come up with ways to make it simply attractive to people to have fewer children. I mean, the Iranian story always surprises everybody. I may have told it to you the last time I was on your show, but they were for a while involved in the biggest population explosion, the highest fertility rate in the history of humanity, because after their Islamic revolution, Iraq attacked them, they were trying to build a 20 million man army to fight off the invaders, and they wanted every fertile Iranian woman to do her patriotic duty and get pregnant. And at the end of the war, the economist who was head of budget went to the Ayatollah and said, we've got a problem because these kids are going to grow up. They're going to need jobs. Our economy can't possibly employ them all. And he warned them that a country filled with a lot of unemployed young men becomes destabilized. He could have been describing Pakistan, where I also went.
Right.
So by then, the Chinese policy had been gone for 10 years, and they knew they didn't want to repeat what China had done because the problems were evident. So what they did was first they made a fatwa saying that there's nothing in the Quran that says if you've got the number of children you can responsibly care for, that you can't use any kind of birth control, including an operation. Second, they made everything available throughout the country and for free. Third, the only thing that was obligatory was premarital classes for young couples. Among other things, they learned how much does it cost to raise, feed, clothe, and educate a kid. And fourth, most important of all, is that they encourage girls to stay in school. Every country I went to, rich or poor, the best contraception is female education, because a girl will postpone her pregnancies while she's studying, and then once she's done, she's got a useful thing to do with her education, but you can't do that with seven kids. So all over the world, if you're educated and you're a female, you will have, on the average, actually fewer than two children. Two children is usually the maximum.
And then there's countries like Germany where people have fewer than two children, and they have a shrinking population without immigration anyway. Are they treating that as a problem? Is it considered a success?
Well, I'm headed to Korea this weekend to give a talk to a country that is very concerned for the same reason as Germany is. Oh, my God, we have a shrinking population. What's going to happen when we have all these seniors to take care of? And if we don't have enough people in the labor pool? Well, I have a whole chapter in Countdown that responds to these economic arguments. Most of it's set in Japan, which is the first country that is dealing with a shrinking population, because they had to cut off their baby boom after World War II by legalizing abortion because their economy was in ruins and pregnant women were watching babies die. They were throwing themselves in front of trains rather than have another one. It turns out that, first of all, that big bubble of these seniors, that balances out after a generation or so because the big overgrown generation dies off, and then suddenly you have a much better balance between younger and older. Second, especially because most people live in urban areas now in the world, a child is an economic asset on the farm. It helps take care of the animals and the crops. In a city, I mean, we love kids, but they're economic liabilities. They don't really contribute to an economy until they're out of school, whereas seniors these days, because of good health care, stay economically active well beyond what we used to call retirement age. The most important thing to me, though, is that as some brilliant economists in Japan and the United States and in Europe have explained to me, is that, yes, as population comes down, GDP is going to shrink. But frankly, none of us care about GDP. Our governments care about it. But all we care about is our personal income. And the GDP, our personal GDP doesn't shrink at all. Because, as you know, we keep consuming. And in fact, we become better at it because when fewer people are born, wage earners become more valuable to the economy. One of the secret reason that economists love big populations is that the more people are born, the cheaper labor is because you got more people competing for jobs. But with fewer, they become more valuable, so wages stay the same or they actually rise, and that redistributes wealth throughout the economy in a way that we can become better purchasers. So there's no reason why per capita income should go down. In fact, it'll probably rise.
Unless we're all replaced, or half of us are replaced by machines.
But that's not such a bad idea. When there's a smaller workforce, we become more innovative, and it's not like we're unemploying people. There's simply going to be fewer workers. So like my chapter in Japan, I started out in a robot factory, And they are basically designing new technology that will help make up some of that labor gap. And innovation sometimes can be a really, you know, human ingenuity is a wonderful thing as long as we use it to keep the wheels turning as opposed to become too greedy and too fat that society collapses under its own weight.
We're talking to Alan Wiseman about his book, Countdown. Let's talk for a moment about Catholicism. After all of these years, and we know that the wheels of the Vatican turned very, very slowly. It took them 500 years to figure out that, or to admit that Galileo was right. But what about birth control and population control? Where does the Vatican stand on that at this point?
Well, I've got a chapter in the Vatican, and this was just before Pope Francis. In fact, one of the cardinals that I was talking to there was on the short list to be the next pope. It turns out that even though Francis is saying some of the really, really important things about ecology and about economy, on birth control, they've got a problem. And that problem is called papal infallibility. It didn't even exist until the middle of the 19th century. And that was back when the Vatican wasn't just 110 acres. It was a middling-sized European country, about a third of what we call Italy today. And it was called the Papal States. But because of a populist uprising, they lost all that territory. So when you're only 110 acres, you need to. How do you maintain power? Well, declaring your leader to be the voice of God, infallible, on matters of morals and religion and dogma, that's pretty powerful. And one of the things that the pontiff back then, it was Pius IX, immediately started to pontificate about was this growing surge of use of diaphragms and condoms in Europe. Basically, they didn't want people having fewer babies because they wanted as many Catholics in the world as possible because Catholics contribute to the coffers. And they maintain that policy. And then we get into the 1960s where the birth control was invented and everybody wanted to use it. And liberation theology nuns and priests in Latin America were saying, you know, we're losing a lot of these souls to Protestant churches because we're telling them that it's a sin, and their churches are saying, oh, we love you for being responsible and only wanting to have the number of children that you can take care of. So under Vatican II Council, John the 23rd called a council to study this, and eventually they voted 69-10 to legalize contraception under canon law. But the dissenting votes submitted a written opinion. By then it was Pope Paul VI. John had died. And that opinion was written by a very intellectual Polish bishop, who we later knew as John Paul II. And he pointed out that if the Catholic Church reversed on this, it would be saying that for a century the Protestants were right and the Catholics were wrong and that all those popes were mistaken, and an infallible pope can't be mistaken. So they're painted into a corner on this issue. Fortunately, though, the Vatican is surrounded by this other Catholic country called Italy, which has one of the lowest birth rates in the world because it has one of the highest rates of female education. And even in this country, 98% of females who are Catholic either use or have used birth controls. Also, we're pretty educated here. So the Catholic Church is losing that particular battle.
You wrote a beautiful essay in Earth Island Journal about a discussion that you've had with your wife, Becky Kravitz, whom we talked to earlier in the program today, about the relative importance of each of your work. And you know, she was saying, well, your work, Alan, journalism, that brings to light these huge life and death problems, environmental problems, is a lot more important than painting opera divas. And you had this beautiful response, and I was wondered if you could talk about it a little bit.
Well, you know, we have this talk periodically, and I always have to remind her what I told her the first time. She was working on this fabulous production at the Los Angeles Opera, and she was painting Placido Domingo's face for that one. And I told her, I said, you know, I just come back from this trip in Colombia where I was watching rainforests being cut down for coca production, and then our tax dollars spraying the coca fields, but mainly spraying the rainforest by mistake, and it was just horrible. And I said, you know, every time I come back from one of these trips and where I've seen another ecosystem go down the drain, and then I can come back and I can see your work and I can hear, you know, someone like Domingo sing, and this transcendent spirit, that's what fills my own spirit up again. You know, it's what makes me proud to be a human being. I said, frankly, you know, I wouldn't want to live in a world without art and music and poetry any more than I'd want to live in a world without trees.
And also, the spirit that makes that kind of work what it is a spirit that, in a way, everybody doing activism and trying to save the world and everybody else maybe can internalize and take into their life and into the way they do what they do, whether even if it isn't art, so to speak.
You know, we all don't have to be artists, but the arts are incredibly important to us. They're provocative, they're inspirational, they just make us realize, wow, I'm proud to be a human being when I see something as beautiful as a Rodin sculpture, or I hear something as amazing as a Beethoven symphony, or, you know, just, you know, tremendous jazz. I mean, just whatever it is that you like out there, it fills you in a deep way that just makes you glad to be a human being. You know, it's like the world without us. As I was saying before, I really wrote it because I want a world with us. I love my species. I love being married to this Homo sapien, Becky Kravitz. And I don't want us to drive ourselves into extinction, because it's not just birds that sing. We contribute beautiful beauty, too. And we're wonderful. But when we're too much of a good thing, then we become too much. And fortunately, I learned doing Countdown that there are ways that we can bring ourselves down to balance with nature surprisingly quickly. Iran came down to replacement rate. That's two people having an average of two children a year faster than China's one-child policy. And, you know,
just through education and voluntary.
Yeah. Yeah. And plus, if we do it by making, you know, contraception is cheap. You know, to provide it for everybody in the world, it would cost less than what the United States was spending per month in Iraq and Afghanistan during the whole last decade, a little over $8 billion. And if we increase female education so every woman in the world has access to it, that would bring down population even faster, and we'd have all these educated women to help us make this transition into how to have sustainable economies that don't depend on constant growth. And there are many ways to do that. Too long to get into here.
Having traveled for the last 2 years talking about this book, what you've seen, the conversations you've had, the different countries that you visited, this book has been translated into 14 languages. Are you hopeful that we might actually reverse the population trend on this earth?
Well, you know, this is the one thing that we can do. Like I say, it's extremely affordable, and there's tremendous benefits to individual families right off the bat. I mentioned Mexico before. Mexico's birth rate came down because of what Mexico loves to do, soap operas. They came up with a soap opera that showed that the big families are in chaos and the small families are sort of in control. And there's cute little episodes where the macho husband and the wife who wants to take birth controls have a big fight, and then he finally sees the light. As that program ran over 10 years, as the viewership increased, the birth rate of Mexico dropped 34%.
Amazing.
Yeah. And there are now soap operas like this in 44 different languages out there. In many of the countries that I went to, I saw street theater doing the same kind of thing. Half the countries in the world right now are either at or below or nearing replacement rate. And some of the big countries that are still very populous, you know, like India, more than half of its states are below replacement rates. So there is a trend right now. This is going in the right direction. And when you make the stuff available, people will use it. So that gives me hope. I mean, look, would we... people sometimes ask me, is overpopulation the biggest environmental problem? And my response is, would we even have environmental problems if there weren't so darn many of us here? So this is fortunately one that doesn't require technological leaps. We know how to do this.
Alan Wiseman is author of several books, including The World Without Us and Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.